You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
2 Timothy chapter 3, Paul begins in verse 1. He says to his friend, the man whom he mentored, Timothy, "Realize this, Timothy, in the last days, difficult times will come." The last days in the New Testament is a construction which could either mean the last days in the sense of the church age, like the age that we're in, all the way from the inauguration of the church on the day of Pentecost in AD 33 to the present moment, and we don't know when it's going to end, whenever Jesus returns. Or it could refer to the end days, the last days in the sense truly the last days, like the end of human history. Either way we look at it, it is saying that there's some kind of a culmination of human history. Time is linear, history is moving toward the culmination in Christ, and whether this is going to be soon or far, we're not sure. Whatever this is, I don't think it's either or, I believe it's both and. Paul is saying to Timothy, avoid men such as these in verse 5. However, this has application for us today. For instance, Jesus clearly speaking about the end of history. Matthew 24, verse 12, he says, "Because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold." And this is precisely what we read about in 2 Timothy chapter 3, is this eerie picture of what it looks like at the end of history when really the train is running off the track. This failed experiment of human autonomy is being revealed for what it is, just a complete nightmare and a disaster. He says, difficult times will come. Oh, what an understatement of a translation. The term here is hard to deal with, difficult, violent, or dangerous. The only other time this is used is in Matthew chapter 8, verse 28, when it refers to a difficult, demon-possessed man. Can you imagine? Yeah, demon-possessed man is pretty difficult to deal with. That's how you talk about a customer at work, not a demon-possessed man. This is talking about extreme violence. At the end of history, there's going to be something that's just completely horrific, tragic, beyond all human imagination or conception. And to call it difficult really doesn't capture it. He continues in verse 2 to kind of explicate and really unpack what he means here. He says, "For people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of the good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God." Do you see what I see? This entire pericope, this section, is bracketed by what? The problem at the beginning is that people will put self, themselves, at the center. And at the end, we see that this is in a complementary fashion, that they would rather do this than put God at the center. They would rather love themselves than love God. So that's kind of an inclusio, kind of like bookends on your shelf that puts everything in the middle, in between. And we see that they'd rather be self-centered than God-centered, rather love themselves than love God. And everything in between is just really adjectives to describe this. We might think about it like this. If we look out at our solar system, we have the sun at the center. And everything works really well because the sun has the gravity and the energy and the heat and the light to provide for the earth and the solar system at large. The difficulty here is this. When we have God at the center of our lives, to make this an analogy for us, it makes sense. But if we put self at the center of the solar system, we're in deep trouble. We're in real bad trouble because that's when everything starts to go off the rails, so to speak. We can't fit the role of God in the world. Many problems with this when you think about it. For one, if I put self at the center of the solar system, the universe, what about the other 7.9 billion other selves out there? They're running around. They also want to be at the center of the solar system. So we got problems in our world. What's wrong with our world? Us. That's the problem. People. People are the problem because we all want to be at the center. We all want to be on the throne. No one has humility. No one can have deference to one another. And so we all want to be at the middle of the universe. That's not our place. And so just rationally speaking, having this kind of a perspective, boy, we're in big trouble. Number two, none of us belong at the center of the universe. Can we really say that we believe that others should just to worship us, to love us, to meet all of our needs? What makes us so special when we have nearly 8 billion other people on this planet? Do I belong there rightfully? And thirdly, and finally, without a transcendent anchor in our lives become incredibly unstable and insecure. What do I mean by this? Well, namely this. Everything that's temporal or imminent, things in our world, this table, that cup, you, me, the chair, the building, everything that's temporal or imminent in our world is itself unstable and is itself very easily insecure. So if I invest my identity into anything that's temporal or anything that's unstable, what follows from that? Well, simply this. My identity is very unstable. My very self is very insecure. So if I were to put my identity into my beauty, let's say, and I went into a terrible car accident and my face was just, you know, ripped apart to ribbons, there would be a double tragedy, right? A double tragedy. For one, there'd be the tragedy that I lost my beauty. But there'd be a second tragedy that's far worse than the first. I didn't just lose my looks. I lost my identity. I lost myself. If I put my identity or myself into my career, if I lose that job, I don't just lose a job. I lose myself. I lose my life. If the stock market is doing well, I'm doing well. If the stock market is doing poorly, I'm doing poorly. Do you see? Do you see the issue? If we invest our identity and ourself and our meaning, significance, and value into anything that is temporal or imminent in this world, we are going to have an unstable and insecure existence. However, if we can anchor our identity and tether it to the transcendent that's above and outside of the universe, to God is what I'm speaking of here. That is a source of identity that can never change. It can never be shaken. It can never rust. It can never go away. Our identity is always secure, always going to be the same. That would be a stability that we would really want to have in our lives, that's for sure. Well, he gives an example of money, lovers of money. And you know, when self is at the center of your life, like if you're a lover of self, one of the outworkings of this could be, might be, possibly could be, being a lover of money, materialism. Now, what's interesting about this is that nobody, maybe few people, would stand up and say, yeah, I love money more than I love people, right? Nobody thinks that they're a materialist. Nobody thinks that they love money more than people. This is precisely what Jesus predicted. He says the love of money, or Paul predicted, the love of money is actually very deceiving. We're deceived by this, by its very nature, that we can be in love with money and with things rather than people, to actually use people to get to things rather than using money to reach and love people. Nobody would say this, but which would they choose? You know, what makes a person emotional? You see somebody have an extraordinary thing happen in their life. They go through a marriage. They go through having a child. They come to faith in Jesus Christ. Nothing there. No emotion. I can't seem to have any kind of emotion to give out to a person. However, I'm incredibly worried when it comes to my finances. I'm incredibly elated when I get that promotion or that job. I'm incredibly angry if you put a dent in my car because that's on a lease and you better not even touch that car. You better not even look at that car. And all of a sudden we realize, what is the thing in which they've invested themselves? Money, materials. Yeah. What makes you emotional? That could be a good signifier right there. Also, what is the thing in which you spend your time, your talent, and your treasure? People say, yeah, you know, my parents, they said that they loved me, and yet they were never around. What does that mean? That's some kind of a dissonance there, where I'm saying one thing, but I'm doing completely the opposite. Your time spent, what you value, the things in which you place your gifts and your talents, this is what you value. This is what you love. And anything else is basically just talk. It's just words. That's all it is. So to have self at the center, I guess this would make sense. Very insecure, though. Very insecure, because if that money goes away, you go away. Now, if God is at the center of your finances, your money, your materials, You're able to give generously, happily. You realize very soon all this money, how much is it going to be worth? Nothing. It's going away forever, along with everything else. I mean, there's going to be a match that's lit. This entire material universe is going to go poof. The only thing that will survive are human persons. And so to give to the cause of Christ, knowing that this is going to impact human people made in the image of God. Oh, dear God. Yeah, that would be something I'd want to give generously to before the time is up. See, this life is going to be over real quick. One of these days, you're going to wake up. And I talk to so many people in that stage of life, and then they get even further, and then it's over. It's over. So quick, so fast. And yeah, to give this money away in a God-centered way, knowing that I'm secure. Jesus said that if he provides for the grass, he provides for the birds. He's going to provide for you. Boastful, arrogant, conceited. This could be another species of loving yourself, right? Species of sin, becoming boastful. Boastful is the word alatzon, which means imposter. To present yourself in such a way that makes you seem like, you know, getting that right angle with the selfie that gives you the right look into the camera. That you're an imposter. You don't really look that hot, but you're trying to look that hot for the shot. All right. Or conceited means to be puffed up, okay? Like in the sense of you, yourself, like an animal, pufferfish, peacock, whatever, trying to make yourself look bigger than you are. Or in the sense that it's puffing up smoke, that you're actually blinded to your own conceit. Either way, boy, that's bad. Self at the center, this would be a way to go because you don't have anything else. You just have yourself. And so consequently, you would want to glorify yourself. There's a difficulty here, however. People who do this, profoundly insecure. Every one of them. People who somehow can twist a story so that, you know, most people, if a director was making a film of the story, they wouldn't even be, you know, an extra. But they can tell the story as though they were the lead role. And they love to boast and talk about how great they are. And they're always able to turn the story around their own gifts and how wonderful they are. Somehow they have this magical ability to do that. Why would they do that? Insecurity. That's why. Nobody boasts when they're hanging out with a bunch of dogs and cats. As C.S. Lewis once put it, if I wanted approval for my books, I wouldn't want a dog to bark about them with his approval. We only boast because we're looking for the security of other people. That's all boasting is. Next time you find yourself tempted to boast, what are you doing? You're saying, I want to take from these other people around me. The problem is, none of us have security apart from God. So I'm a broken vessel trying to get liquid from another broken vessel. And I could get a lot of broken vessels on Instagram and Facebook and whatever else we use today. It wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter. Adding a bunch of zeros to another zero gives me zero. Consequently, these people are quietly obsessed with what other people think. They always want to know what people are saying about them, what people think about them. In many cases, this can turn into neuroses where we start to wonder, people are looking at me, they're thinking about me, they're talking about me. People don't think about you as much as you do. From a God-centered point of view, we can agree with the author of the Proverbs, the 27th chapter, verse 2. Let another praise you, not your own mouth. Let another praise you, not your own mouth. Yes, to have other people, if they're recognizing something special that you did, your hard work, your labor, your love, we can let them talk about that. We don't need to speak about it. We don't need to talk about it. Let other people praise you if they have something to say. And when they praise you, you know what you say? Thank you. That's what you say. Thank you. You don't say, well, it was not a big deal or whatever you talk about. You don't increase on it or anything. You just say, thank you for your kind words. And that's all. That's all you got to say. Ultimately, we're looking forward to the day, according to 1 Peter chapter 1, right around verses 9, 10 in there, where it says that Jesus will actually issue praise, glory, and honor unto us. Or in the words of Paul, 1 Corinthians 2:7, that he did all this before the foundation of the world so that he could glorify you, us. Yeah, to get the praise that comes from God, that's the kind of praise. The only two eyes in the universe that I care about looking at me, for him to be looking at me and saying, you did a great job. This is dreaming too small, getting other insecure people liking me. No, we got something way better if God is at the center rather than me. Then there's revilers, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, brutal, treacherous. Yeah, that word revilers is blasphemos. Maybe you recognize that term. A blasphemer. To blaspheme a person, to revile them. To use your words in such a way that it's just cruelty. Or diabolos. Maybe you recognize that word. The devil. This isn't saying that people are devils, plural. It's saying that they're acting like the devil. To be not just a gossip, but a malicious gossip. To be tearing people down, saying things that are false. For what purpose? How are they using their words in an unloving way? That there's no intent. There's no intent here that I'm saying these things behind your back or to your face to build you up, to help you, to correct in love. What is this? This is here just to tear down. This could include sarcasm. Sarx in Greek means flesh. Sarcasm means to tear flesh. Using sarcasm to constantly needle at people is literally to tear their flesh. Spondos means literally a treaty, and then the alpha privative means not, no treaty. This was used in military warfare where you'd have two rival armies coming out to face each other. A spondos, no treaty. We're going to war, baby. And we're both going back to our parties and saying we're going to fight. Irreconcilable. This is how relationships are. When self is at the center, everything is at stake, isn't it? Everything. So if I'm at the center, and you have the same position, you're at the center, we are in a standoff, there is no reconciling here. There is no treaties, there's no peacemaking. It's, well, this is all out war. Brutal. Brutal people, brutal words. Using your words in a brutal, another way to translate this is untamed, like an animal, has no control over itself. Or savage is another translation, savage words. To rip people down, treacherous. You can't trust these kind of people, Timothy, is what he's saying. Boy, when self is at the center, we use our words to win. As I said, everything is at stake. If it's only me, myself, and I've got to win this fight. However, there's something interesting about these kind of people. They're never happy. They want to win, win, win. They want to punish. They want to be brutal. They want to be malicious. Attack, 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 win at all costs. You know, it doesn't matter if we're lying. The point is, do we win? Can we destroy this other person? It eats you away from the inside. It's like looking at the other person, wishing they would die. A certain part of your humanity is dying inside, where you're something less than human at that point. When we have God at the center, whoa, that's different. It's not me versus you. It's not that I'm such a big deal. That I need to stick up for every single thing I did or said. God is in the picture. Whoa, 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 whoa. So it isn't that I'm just trying to square off with you. It's that both of us are turning to God. And so we're very quick, to show our own contribution. Now, I know what you're thinking. Well, he said more. He did more. So how much of a percentage did he do? Oh, I don't know, 70, 80%. All right. So he contributed 80% to the, let's go 90% to the conflict. All right. 90% was him. 10% was you. Have you owned up to your 10%? No. Then don't talk to me about his 90. Jesus said, before you go to get the speck, that little speck, hey, dude, you got a, it's right here. No, the other eye there. Before I can get that speck out of your eye, you got to get the log out of your own eye. Can you imagine? That's comedy, baby. A log sticking out of your eye. Like, imagine that. Like, he's like moving it around and like, let me get the speck. He's like, you're hitting me in the face. It hurts. Matthew 7, 3 through 5. You're not authorized to go and get the speck until you get the log out. You are the most sinful person that you know. All right. You have inner access to your own private thoughts and emotions and will. You know how sinful you are. You can't own up to your 10%. And let's be honest here. It's often more than 10%, isn't it? Wouldn't the other person say it's 10%? What happens here is that when we can admit our own faults, the other person is very quick to admit their faults. And then we can be very quick to forgive. Why? Because if it's just me versus you, and you truly hurt me, I mean for real, I don't mean some kind of a slight or you're being sarcastic or you gossip behind my back. I mean, you hurt me. When I know that God, the ultimate judge, is in the picture, I know that either you're going to have to answer for what you did, or what you did was paid for at the cross of Jesus Christ. This is the teaching that can stop retaliation against other people. Do you realize that? If I didn't believe in a God who judges, I would want to get judgment for myself, wouldn't I? But because I believe in a God who judges, I don't need to judge. I don't need to get retaliation. I can leave that with God. I can let it go. Aphesis is the word to forgive. It means to release. I'm releasing it. I'm not going to nurture it. I'm not going to replay it in my mind. I'm not going to keep thinking about it. I'm letting it go. I'm leaving it at the cross of Christ. As one person put it, when Jesus was talking with Peter, Peter said, "How much do we forgive people?" And he asked, "Up to 7 times?" That seemed like a lot to Peter. "Up to 7 times, Lord?" And Jesus said, "No, 77 times. And there's cases in which we have to forgive 77 sins. And yet there's other cases where we have to forgive 77 times for the same sin. There's times where people have hurt us, it's wounding, and we forgive them, and then we wake up the next morning in that bitterness, that anger is there again, and we got to say, God, I'm choosing to forgive again. And then we wake up the next Monday, and there it is again, it burbles up, and we're saying, I release it again, I forgive them again. Oh, if you're harboring bitterness, hurt in your heart, let it go. Leave it at the cross of Christ. You wouldn't believe. All of a sudden, your prayer life comes back online. You can read the scriptures. Sitting there as a forgiven person, the most forgiven person on earth as a Christian and a child of God, holding people in contempt. That is just you're a walking contradiction. And God says, you need to deal with that before we can move over into dealing with the other person. David Burns, now this guy is a secular thinker, he's not a Christian. He's an adjunct professor of psychiatry at Stanford School of Medicine. He writes this, check this out. He says, when you blame others for your relationship problems, the likelihood of recovery is zero. Let me repeat that. When you blame others for your relational problems, the likelihood of recovery is zero. I might repeat it a third time because I don't believe that you believe that. You believe the solution is to get at their relational problems. However, he says, I'm not aware of any techniques powerful enough to help people who blame others for the problems in their relationships. This idea that I'm just going to retaliate and be malicious, brutal toward other people, make them pay, never works. It's never worked. I don't know what counseling theory you're following. Does not work until you can own up to your own stuff and then come in and forgive. That's the way of Jesus. And this is where relationships are repaired, they're reconciled, they come right back to life. It's unbelievable. Every single time. Unbelievable. Well, ungrateful and unholy. I could describe our culture right there. Ungrateful people. Living in the richest, most affluent nation in the history of humans. And we walk around most days being ungrateful. For example, Dave Ellis on Twitter said this, I just had a cup of tea with soy milk. It was one of the worst decisions I've ever made in my life. Or, put too much balsamic vinegar on my salad, and now I'm dying. Or, JT2DaExtreme, really sick and tired of this place using too much orange zest in my brunch mimosa. Sick and tired of this place using too much orange zest in my brunch mimosa. Oh, that guy should be slapped in the face. How about this person here? Salad bar for 15 minutes to find that they add no egg or giant couscous. To say this has ruined my Monday would be an understatement. what terrible people. The problem is, that's me. I read those and I was like, that's kind of me though. Like, I don't drink mimosas or whatever, but a couple weeks ago, we had this thing happen in our house where we were at home and I turned on the water faucet and the water didn't come out of the faucet. And it turns out you got to pay your water bill, right? Like if you don't pay, they don't give you any water. I didn't know that. So they're like, yeah, we shut it off until you pay. I'm like, right, we'll pay, just give me the money. And like, they're like, no, we're going to give you like 48 hours before we come back. Just like teach you a lesson, young man, you know? And so for 48 hours, I didn't have water. And I was, oh my God, I was grumbling the whole time. I had this like this sheen of like sweat and filth and shame over me. And I like couldn't take a shower anywhere. And I usually do that like every day. You know, I know some of you are like, I do that like once every couple weeks. And that's wrong. Just so you know, like maybe that's the thing you learned tonight. It's like it's one shower every day or two, just so you know. Are we clear? Good. But I remember after like a day, I can't tell you how many times I went to turn on the faucet and it's like, oh, no water again. And then no water. Like, oh, we'll wash our clothes at least. No water. For 2 days, I couldn't tell you what it felt like when they turned it back on. I just sat in the shower for 2 hours. I took a wonderful bubble bath. I didn't really, but it was amazing to be able to not have the water. And it's this thing that you don't even know. Like every time you turn on your water faucet, you don't think about it until it's missing. So ungrateful, apart from God, you know, basically people walk around with these deep feelings of disappointment all the time, where I'm constantly looking at other people, these upward social comparisons. Social media has really been a detriment to our culture in many ways. I know there's some positives to it. This is not one of them. We're looking at other people's highlight reels of their lives, and we're comparing it to our sadness and our worst moments in our lives. So we're seeing these upward social comparisons. We're never satisfied in this ungrateful, bitter position where we're constantly wanting more and more and more, and we never feel like what we've been given is good enough. We're never happy, constantly discontent. This isn't God's way. Here's God's way right here. Lamentation 3:23, this is in the midst of the exile. And Jeremiah writes this, "Great is God's faithfulness. His mercies begin afresh each morning." Every morning, if you know Jesus Christ, you can wake up and just say, "This day was given to me as a gift." You know, it's not that my life is going to be cut short. It's that I was given any life at all. This water coming out of the faucet, I don't deserve this. Most people on earth don't have drinkable water. You know that, right? I have a car that runs. I've got friends. I'm surrounded by people who love me. When this life is over, what's the worst that can happen? I go to heaven for eternity, and I'm sitting here feeling bad about myself. Am I going to pity a person like that who's surrounded by loved ones, who has 3 meals a day, has got his bills paid for? Am I going to feel bad for a guy like that? No, I will not feel bad for a guy like that. And neither should you. You should not be waking up every day with anything other than this, realizing this is a mercy of God that I'm even here today. Thank you, God. You've given me another day to live. Ungrateful, unholy, without self-control, haters of the good, lovers of pleasure. This could really describe our culture as well, an addicted culture. Sexaholics, alcoholics, workaholics, every aholic you could think of. Addiction is just so pervasive in our culture. Here's the thing. As Americans, we love our freedoms. We want to have freedoms. And we do have freedoms, right? That's good. Freedom is a good thing. The problem is freedom and pleasure and addiction contradict each other. So some limitations are actually liberating, right? For example, if I give the limitation to get to bed before midnight rather than staying up and watching some show all night until 4 a.m, if I limit myself, I'm liberated in the morning when I wake up to go to work, right? But you're saying, no, you're getting rid of your freedom. Okay, that's what a child would say. A child would say, you're not letting me do what I want. Right, only so you can have greater freedom for the next entire 24 hours. If I want to have a healthy life, I need to restrict my freedom in what I eat and what I do. Everywhere we look in life, we have conflicting freedoms. There's sometimes where restraints are actually liberating and liberties are devastating. We're free to seek pleasure, but we're not free to stop. That is addiction right there. Am I free to go do that? Yeah, you're free to go do that. Well, what's to stop me? Nothing. Nothing is going to be able to get you to stop. Once you become addicted, then you're hooked. That's where it becomes a difficulty. Jesus said in John 8:34, anyone who sins is a slave to sin. Sin is actually enslaving. Like, let's think about the history of erectile dysfunction for a second. Woo, all right. One guy is like, I'm really interested. 1948, Kinsey studied men from ages 30 to 45 had erectile dysfunction between 1 and 3% of the population. Jump forward 50-some years, 2002. Men under age 40, the same age bracket, had erectile dysfunction 2% of the time. So not much has changed in 50 years. Wait a minute. Then 2006 hits, high-speed internet. And, you know, everyone at the time of high-speed internet was just downloading, like, research articles and, you know, doing schoolwork and stuff and, like, connecting with the greater human community. Remember? That's what we thought. Like, we would all just, like, have, like, a big Shangri-La and it'd be great. We all love each other and stuff. No, they downloaded lots and lots of porn in 2006. Like, terabytes, just terabytes of porn. As much as you could download. And check this out. From 2002 to 2010, erectile dysfunction, same age bracket, 35%. Here's the point. Some restraints are liberating. Some liberations are actually restraining. And if you can't get your sexuality under control right now, what makes you think that you'll be able to do it later? If you can't get this under control and restrain yourself, what makes you think you'll have to be able to enjoy sex for the rest of your life? Well, when we have God at the center of pleasure, what do we have here? 1 Timothy 6, verse 17. God richly supplies, like he's giving everything he can here, supplies us with all things to enjoy. Sex, food, drink. I'm speaking of alcohol there. Yeah. Enjoying people, friendships, parties. Yeah, that's great. But take it easy on yourself, for God's sakes. It's there to enjoy. It's a great world. He's given us a beautiful world. He's given us the ability to experience pleasure. But can we limit ourselves, restrain ourselves, without being a lover of pleasure, without self-control? And finally, disobedient to parents. When self is at the center of a family unit, all you're going to face is disintegration. You know, when you try and bring a family together, but each individual person wants to be their own God. Everyone wants them to worship them, and when they want their way, that is a recipe for disaster, to be sure. We see this in our culture. The divorce rate on your first marriage is 41 to 50%. Your second marriage, it jumps up 60 to 67%. Your third marriage, 74%. Imagine playing Russian roulette, only three out of the six chambers are filled with bullets. That's what marriage is today, 50%. This is when everyone's coming into a marriage saying, I want to be first. How does this affect kids? Kids from divorced homes versus married homes. How about their relationship with their mother? Kids from divorced homes have twice as much of a poor relationship with mom. What about behavioral problems with adolescents? Kids from divorced homes, 2.5 to 3.5 times the behavioral issues with mom. I could roll this data out all night long. Paul Amato, Judith Wallerstein, Mavis Hetherington, who's on the other side of the fence, even she will admit to this. In fact, that's her. That's in the footnote right there, E.M. Hetherington. This is from her study. She's one who says, no, you bounce out of it when you get older. You eventually do fine when you get older. No, this is a pain that you experience moving through your entire life. Even that expression, disobedient to parents. Many of us here didn't grow up with two parents. For us, it was disobedient to parent. In the ancient world, at least there was two parents in the house. Today, we can't even say that. So the family unit is disintegrating. What we see here as well is even if the parents stay together, if self is at the center, they don't want to love the kids. They don't want to make time for the kids. They wouldn't want to like take them out to eat, you know, get like a regular weekly time with your kid. Like they'll watch TV for 20 hours a week and they'll work 50, 60, 70 hours a week. But they had kids just to put them with a nanny or to put them away with somebody else. And when the kid is home, they want to put them in front of a screen. When they go out to dinner, they give them an iPad and a video game system to look at. They don't want kids. They don't want to invest in their children. Why? Because self is at the center. What they want is what is supreme. Consequently, kids have no desire to respect parents like this. Josh McDowell was the one who said, rules without relationship leads to rebellion. Rules without relationship leads to rebellion. Why would I want to respect dad when I hate dad? Why would I want to respect mom when I don't even know mom? You know, in most homes, dad is either so checked out and lethargic, we don't see him. He's a workaholic. He's, you know, out in his, you know, den watching television, doing whatever. We don't even see him. He's not emotionally engaged. He's not spiritually engaged. He's not relationally engaged. Nothing. There's nothing there. Or dad rules like a tyrant. Dad comes in and lays down the law, and he's authoritarian. In the biblical view of a family, dad is supposed to be a source of strength and protection in the home, but also a source of tenderness, both security and also deep love. Many of us never had this. You never had a mom who was there. She only disciplined you. She never loved you. There was no regular time. The idea of sitting down and having a conversation with mom, having a conversation with dad, just sounds deplorable. This is the biblical picture. When we have God in the center and we take self out of the equation, substantial healing. I don't know what you've come from. Doesn't matter. You can be substantially healed by Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ heals families. He heals marriages. He heals you. You get to choose what you liked about your family. The traditions and the things that you liked and the vacations. And you're like, I want to keep those parts. I love that part about my dad. We're not turning sour against our parents. Nothing like that. Remember, we're forgiving. But we're taking the parts that we're like, yes, I want to keep that. And guess what? We're leaving behind the parts that we don't. We're saying, I'm leaving that with them. And we're going to start our own family. And God is going to be at the center. Well, he concludes in verse 5, they will hold to a form of godliness, although they have denied its power. Later he says in chapter 4, I believe it's verse 3, they will get teachers to tickle their ears to tell them the things that they want to hear. Yeah. Here's a question to conclude with. If you were wrong about your spiritual views, would you want to know? Would you want to know that? Like if you believe something about the afterlife and ultimate reality and about God, would you want to know that? Well, I'm just here to tell you that Jesus Christ says that he is the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to God except through him. So the Christian message is very exclusive. You have to come through Christ. But it's inclusive because Jesus also said, anyone who comes to me, I will surely not reject. So it's exclusive only through Jesus. It's inclusive in a sense. He'll take you in a second, right now, in your heart. If you want to come to him, he will accept you. If you want to pray to him and say, I want you in my life. I want to be forgiven. I want to go to heaven. If you pray that, that's a prayer he always answers every single time. Pretty wild. Well, as we wrap up, are you tired of living a life for self? Is this exhausting to you? Do you want to see your life changed substantially? Not totally. I'm not promising you're going to turn into this wonderful person who's never sad anymore, anything like that. That's a bunch of baloney. What I'm saying here is that your life will be changed substantially in a good way. Wouldn't you want to be a more grateful person, more loving person, kind, forgiving? Wouldn't you love that in your life? You got to start a relationship with Christ. You have to. We can't change self, a broken self, with a broken self. We need a perfect, loving self to do that for us. We need Jesus Christ. You need Jesus Christ. Invite him into your life. You won't regret it.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.